Great. Well, we're now being recorded. And Mark, are you here?
Yep.
Good. Well, why don't you go ahead and just take over here.
All right, let's go ahead and get started. Well, first of all, thank you, everybody, and welcome to our May Story Lab. Today is Thursday, May 21st, and I'm very excited to introduce Jeff Lineweaver, who has, like, many accomplishments after his name, but let me just share with you some of them. And first and foremost, the most recent and current one is that he just released a new book entitled Storytelling for Sustainability, Deepening the Case for Change. And the book was released this month, and you can absolutely order it. And Jeff and I had a chance to talk a little bit before this meeting, and I love the cover, and I love the story that he weaves through the book. So I won't steal any of his thunder, because I'm hoping he'll share a little bit about what's going on with his book and that in a minute. But Jeff is a doctor, he is a storyteller, he's a sustainability strategist, a writer, educator, he's a managing partner at an organization called Global Zen Sensibility. He's also a faculty member at the Bainbridge Graduate Institute and at Pinchot University. And my goodness, the list goes on and on and on. And so, rather than continue with this list, I'd rather have you be engaged with what he has to share. And Jeff, maybe if there's anything else that you'd like to introduce or share with us before we get started, then as soon as you do that, I've got a couple of questions for you to kind of guide our discussion.
Okay, sure. I would say I'm Global Zen Sustainability, although we are sensible.
I say sensibility. I'm sorry.
No, that's totally fine. Well, I am just really thrilled to be here and talk with everyone on the call today. I am. How many people are on the call? I was trying to take count. We have like 10.
Yeah, probably close to 10.
Okay, that's great. Sometimes I feel like when you're in conference calls, it's a little bit like we're all in Star Trek and we've been beamed into a large walk-in closet with the light off, and we're searching for our keys. So you don't know who's here. This is great. I am looking forward to talking with you all and telling you a little bit about myself, about what I do and how I'm working with story, and talk a little bit about the book. And why don't I let you, Mark, go ahead, and we'll kind of go from there and see what happens.
So, sustainability, sensibility, oh my goodness. So maybe you could help get us started, because I know that sometimes I'm not always clear on, so what does sustainability really mean? Is it a bunch of people going out and saving the trees? Is it about, recycling? Is it about business continuity? What is sustainability, at least, kind of from your perspective?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a question that I ask at almost every place I go and work, because so many people have a different meaning of what sustainability is. And I think that that's an interesting reason why I'm working with story. But I think that, in a broad brush approach, sustainability, at least from kind of a professional or organizational perspective, it's about corporate social responsibility and something called the triple bottom line, which is having organizations consider people, planet, and the profit, not just kind of looking at the bottom line of money, but looking at why environmental issues matter and why social issues matter, and how the environmental issues and the social issues are kind of connected through a continuum. And, environmental justice is social justice, and social justice is environmental justice. And organizations have a huge part in making change or creating misery. And so, but sustainability is one of those crazy terms. Sometimes people will say, they'll think of things as green. So I often ask people, what's the difference between green and sustainability? And herein lies the problem, where people get confused about that. And I'd be curious, just as we kind of walk through our call today, if people, I'm curious just to kind of call out to the group, does everyone have their own different view of sustainability? Anybody want to chime in?
This is Dave in Pittsburgh, and I would say yes, but I come from a biased standpoint, my son just finished getting his PhD, and part of it was in sustainability studies. So I do a lot of talking with CEOs, and I talk to them about green being the money behind sustainability, how you can make money if you're a sustainable organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Anybody else?
Yeah, this is Pete. I spent 37 years with the U.S. Forest Service, so I suspect that my idea of sustainability might be a little different from other folks. I tend to think of sustainability as the use of resources in a sustainable manner, fully recognizing that things like fossil fuel extraction certainly aren't sustainable, but harvesting of our forests is over the long run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you. Anyone else?
This is Mark. You know, I come from a background in working with organizations, especially in the financial services industry and, you know, healthcare and others, but specifically financial services. And gosh, our, you know, the way we define sustainability was being able to come back the next day and keep doing the work we've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it really didn't have much to do with, at least as it was defined in the moment, with as much corporate responsibility other than, you know, we have to honor our employees, our community, and, you know, and our customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I, you know, thank you for everybody kind of, you know, chiming in and sharing your thoughts, because I think that for me, what's so interesting about the question of what does sustainability mean, or what's the difference between sustainability and green, is it continues to remind me of, you know, there was a number of years back, there was a project with NASA and the European Space Agency, and they sent a rover to Mars, and it got all the way to Mars and then promptly crashed, in part because people, they realized that half the organization was using a metric, and the other half was using a U.S. standard measurement. And and you'd think that these baseline issues, like, you know, with rocket scientists of all people, that that we would you know, that we would have an understanding of shared meaning. But what I find more and more is that we are living in a crisis of meaning making, and that unless we go and have deeper conversations about some really important words like sustainability, as one example, that we're all kind of working in this kind of murky perspective of how we're communicating. And I personally find that, you know, the stories matter. But when we're working in kind of a murk, sometimes the right stories don't shine through, and the urgency of the time doesn't show up. And so I think that for me, the issue with sustainability, from organizational perspective, you know, there is of course corporate social responsibility in a lot of these official reports. But I think to Pete, coming from a different, you know, being sustainable, financially sustainable. But we do have these issues of resources on the planet and a growing issue with climate change, and we are missing some urgency. And I often tell a story about there was a Viking named Eric the Red about 1,000 years ago, and Eric, he took a bunch of colonists, and they left medieval Norway. And they sailed all the way over to what is now Greenland and found a fjord that seemed a lot like home, and they set up a colony, and they lived there for about 500 years, making sure that they traded back home. But they try to basically recreate their lifestyle in this place in Greenland about 1,000 years ago. And somewhere along the kind of 400, you know, year 490 of their stay, things started to change, and the climate changed, their livestock died, and social order started to break down, and all of a sudden, the whole colony collapsed and died, and people did not hear of them again for another 500 years. But in the same space, at the same time, there were a group of Inuit First Nations villages. And they all survived. And so, to me, this is a really interesting aspect of the time that we're living in, because oftentimes organizations don't talk enough about the big stories. But this is a situation where we have two sets of populations living in the same place, and one collapsed and the other one lived. And this is a common, you know, in research they've shown, you know, Easter Island, all throughout Micronesia, this has happened on the Anasazi, the Mayans, that things happen. And that in the case of this Eric the Red, they, you know, they could have eaten food, and they could have learned how to kind of understand what was going on in the world around them, but they had a story about the other. And in this case, it was a story about the Inuit and how they were uncivilized and they were awful people. And so they didn't even want to be friends with them or do anything like them. And yet these people survived and the Vikings didn't. And so story is a very interesting thing. And as I always say, there's no business and there's no organizations on a dead planet. And I think it's really important for us to understand that that we're not communicating well, and that more and more people are trying to tell stories, but there are a lot of bad habits out there in terms of how we tell stories and how we share meaning making, and there's a great deal of information coming out as an example from Yale climate scientists and climate communication researchers that are showing that, as an example in America, that we have now moved into what they're calling the six Americas, where we are living in six story silos between people who are alarmed about what's going on in the world and people who are completely dismissive. But these people are learning to tell stories only to the same people that, you know, it's kind of preaching to the choir. And so story is becoming a tool for groupthink and denial, and not helping others kind of see what's really going on around us and being in communication the way old stories used to be. And this is really important because there is a lot of change. And what they found is that it's not just about climate change. It's about wars over resources and loss of trade and business and environmental degradation and political stubbornness that are all different types of stories that are being told, but it's locking us in place. And so my job, really, as a storyteller, first and foremost, is to help kind of bunker bust these story silos that we're working in. And because I feel at the end of the day, people are inherently good, and people want to do the right thing, and people are driven by their sense of inner fate and destiny, that inner story. You know, we talk a lot about the hero's journey, but I don't think we talk enough about kind of the role of fate and destiny and why we really want to create change in the world. And so I spend a lot of time with people who, you know, I often say the world is an AA meeting waiting to happen. But when it comes to sustainability, it's happening quite a bit. I can't tell you how many times I sit down with CEOs who on one hand are, you know, trying to do the best and kind of corralling a big organization around their sustainability efforts and creating and being transparent. But privately, they're also terrified. And so I have found that I have a unique background where I am a performing, I've been a performer, played violin professionally and sung professionally and acted for many years, and grew up in a kind of a theater family, but I had never really kind of switched over to storytelling. But I went and got a PhD in organizational development, looking at narrative and organizations and identity. And then I work in this professional level with organizations and at a graduate level. And so I have more and more started bringing the performative old style forms of storytelling into my work in the boardroom and in the graduate education, and people are loving it up. I think that there's something about telling the old stories, and when I say the old stories, I'm talking about kind of the big mythic tales, and I typically play a drum or another instrument where, in many cases, it puts people into trance. But people are opening up, and the story creates the right container for people to share about what's going on in the world without kind of outing themselves. And I feel that the kind of bringing in the old stories with organizational stories allows me to tell truths without the use of facts in organizations that have been using facts to try to tell stories, but they've forgotten how to tell a story, and they only do what I say is they are fact tellers, and they just have this bad habit of only using facts to communicate, and they keep don't understand why people don't understand the data. So I think that's a longer way around coming back to your question, Mark, about sustainability and what is it. But, you know, I think for me it's as much as a kind of the corporate approach to sustainability of triple bottom line or making sure the organization is stable. And it's also about this greater big story that the world is changing. You know, we're going to have 9 billion people on this planet in 20 years. We're at 7 billion people. At the beginning of the 20th century, we had 1 billion people. And it's a big issue. And we need to learn how to live together better and share resources and deal with the F word, which I say is fair. And the primary medium that we have for our understanding of the world around us is story. So so what do you think? Do you have any questions?
I'll open it up to the group, and if there are no questions, I do have a question or two, but let me open it up to the group. Based on what Jeff was sharing, thoughts, questions?
Jeff, this is Bill Brown. I'm very intrigued by your bunker-busting idea as far as breaking down the silos. If we're in 6 different silos, and it's indicative not only, let's say, the overall view, but within a company you can even see those same kind of silos, how do you create a story that has a universal truth to it? You've got all those different factions and they each believe their own truth. How do you break through that? What's your technique, I guess?
Well, I have been spending a lot of time, you know, I always say that one of the trickiest things about storytelling is that it's, first of all, it's an inherently invisible. And so I work a lot within organizations to help them make their stories, to make the invisible visible. And in doing so, it allows people to truly get on the same page. And so that's one way of kind of breaking up the bunker busting, is just helping us be better communicators with one another and learning how to see kind of our story patterns. So as one example of how I work with organizations, I have adapted Kurt Vonnegut. You know, Kurt Vonnegut was the American writer and storyteller. He was fascinated with the patterns of stories, and he created kind of an XY axis of how to kind of draw a story. And, you know, and he found these universal themes, such as like the hero's journey would be a type of pattern. And I've taken, he basically has an XY axis that starts with, on the Y side, it would be good fortune and ill fortune, or good luck or bad luck. And you start with the beginning and an end. On the X axis, and you have people, you know, if it was a fictional story like a Star Wars, you might kind of start where things are kind of having bad luck, and then it slowly rises, and then it crashes below the X-axis, and you kind of draw the story. And so I've taken this, and I do this with lots of groups where we start learning how to map the different stories that are going on. And in doing so, we, one, don't use words. And I find that the more we use words, the more things get complicated. So and one example with this, you can imagine if I have a team of 10 and I say, tell me a story about, you know, let's say it's the onboarding process. What has been your experience? But people don't want to actually name it, because as soon as you name it, you have all these power issues show up, all the unmentionables. And so this has been one way where if you have a group of people kind of draw their story, there's no real word that kind of highlights an issue, but it can kind of show the showed the difference between all the people who have maybe gone through the same onboarding experience. So it's, you know, obviously the goal would be to have make sure that the kind of the sine wave of that pattern for everybody to come together so they are literally telling the same story. So that's one way I do it. I also work with a lot of right brain drawing with different story silos and different groups. You know, this is what I'm really doing, kind of organizational facilitation of this, in part because what I talk to a lot of folks about is, you know, I mentioned this idea of fact telling, where we, you know, we're just overly locked in with data, and you know, we use the metaphor of bullet points, right? So I'm going to shoot my idea into your head. I'm going to, you know, I think whoever tells the best story wins, is not necessarily always helpful. We don't know what games are going on, and it creates a fear-based workplace when people feel like they can win or lose the story wars. And so helping people go and kind of storyboarding experiences. I've even had a team start doing mandala work, where we start with images first, and people are allowed to have some flex and how they tell their stories without using words. And that has been a great thing for people, just to kind of visualize what's going on. I mean, that's essentially what we're doing with the brand, right? With the brand, we want people to associate a bigger story, but you're still able to have your own story, and I'm still able to have my own story, but we have a relationship with that brand and that brand image. And in this way, it's been really helpful because people aren't just living in these kind of invisible worlds of microaggressions, as an example, in a workplace, because people just are struggling in a crisis of meaning making. So those are just some ways in which I bunker bust silos. Other times, it's coming and telling big stories that are mythic stories. You know, I'll come in and they may not know that I'm going to bring my drum or some of my other instruments, and I will open it up, and, you know, you essentially have to talk about the dead elephants in the room, and that's one of the things you do as a consultant, is you're able to come in and name the issues that people are afraid to name, but you do so through story, and, it's why we have the Emperor Has No Clothes story, right? it's kind of dancing that dance, too. So I hope that answers some of your question. I realize if we had PowerPoints, I could kind of show you a little bit of what I'm talking about with some of the making the invisible visible of the patterns, that's certainly one thing.
Definitely,
interesting. I love the way that you just shared with the group how story is a language in and of itself, whether we use words or not, and that it could have, you know, a big enough impact, but still be communication.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Absolutely. You know, another big piece that it's been super important about this kind of this fact-telling idea is the overuse of data. You know, I think first and foremost, it's really important with organizations and leaders for people to understand that we use the term change all the time, but we never ask, is this adaptive change or is this maladaptive change? Is this a bad habit? And so I think another part of the work that I do that's important is, particularly around sustainability, is asking, you know, have we learned to tell the wrong stories well? Are we telling stories that enable bad habits for the organization? You know, how do we get in there and kind of shift the telling of that story so we stop enabling bad habits? And how do we shift stories that are actually enabling kind of mass consumerism without the need for doing so?
Is there an example that you could give around that? Because that's an interesting concept.
Sure. Well, if people have, you can certainly Google her name. Her name is Annie Leonard, and she put together a visual story called The Story of Stuff. And The Story of Stuff was really just a passion of hers, and she wanted to tell a story about kind of mass consumerism and how we are unaware of the whole kind of waste chain and how we are living in a trance of needing more and more and more stuff at cheaper, cheaper rates, but we're unaware of what happens. We're unaware of just, you know, when we buy a $3 clock at Walmart, we may not know the kind of the untold story of how that clock got to be there and all the hands and everything else that goes into the clock that we just take for granted and pull off the shelf. And, you know, this started with her story of stuff started as this project, but it had enough of a kind of a stickiness that it grew into this global phenomenon. You know, has now been seen by millions of people, and now she is, it's created an organization. It's, you know, creating change, and it's telling a story of these complex issues of our connected, you know, how we're connected to, you know, waste and stuff, but it's explaining it through story, and people can now get that without having to be kind of beat over the head with data. So I think that's one really interesting piece of it. I also think that there's been more and more research that's shown, like I'm kind of thinking of the headline, why millions die and while millions die and people do nothing. And and it's also kind of the power of the individual story. So in this case for Annie Leonard, it was about her and her kind of her ability to bring these things forward. But they are now statistically showing that as an example, if you are with a charity organization and you're trying to get money for people to save some children in Ethiopia, that they have found that if you just show the numbers of, you know, 3 million children are dying and that's it, or you just show a group of people, that people are not actually responding. But the more they bring in kind of the one person story plus a little bit of the data, that it kind of triggers this empathy. So there's this interesting kind of also correlation about once we need to know about the individual story, and we need to kind of corkscrew into that, because otherwise we're telling bad stories that, you know, we think we're telling a story. We could be talking about a group, but it's not, people don't feel compassionate. So there's a real kind of a brain trigger. And so I think that she's a great example of kind of telling a story that helped people see the individual in it and see her in it. But it's also, how do we talk about these big issues going on and personalize it? So it's not just about the people that live over there. It's about your friend Bob, who is living in it. So that's been a very interesting thing to kind of watch this progression of kind of bad habit stories and essentially good habit stories.
Do you have a particularly favorite that you like to share? I know you shared, you know, two quick stories about, you know, the U.S. standard versus metric and rocket scientists and Eric the Red. But is there a standard story or one of your favorites that you want to share with us?
Well, there's a story that I often tell that just to get people to understanding about the power of story as a belief system. And the story is, you know, once upon a time, there was an old man, and he lived in the woods. And among all of his favorite things, the possession he cared about the very most was this amazing oak-handled axe that his grandfather's grandfather had made and given to him. And now he was an old man, and it was his, and he knew that this one day will go to his son. But this axe was the most important possession to him in all the world. And one day he walked into his house and he noticed that that axe was gone, and he panicked and he started ripping up the house, looking everywhere, and he could not believe that his favorite axe would be missing. And he was sure that somebody had come into that house and stole his axe. And as this was going on, he looked out the window and he saw this boy walking by. And it was the neighborhood boy, and he looked at him, and you know what? He walked like a thief. He looked like a thief, and he went out, and he grabbed him by the scruff of the collar, and he said, "Where is my axe?" And the boy said, "What axe are you talking about?" And the man said, "You sound just like a thief." And he tried to get the boy thrown into jail. Well, a few weeks passed. Boy tried to avoid the man, and the old man went into the woods, and he went to his favorite place where he loved to chop wood, and there in the forest was this axe sitting at the same place that he left it last time he had cut down some wood. So he gathered his axe and he went home, and he was sitting inside his house, and he happened to look out the window, and that same boy was walking by. And you know what? He looked and he walked and he spoke just like anybody else. And I love that story, because story is our everything. It's the primary meaning-making vehicle that we have, even if, though it's as much fictional as it is true to life. Story is the most powerful force on the planet. I think of the Holocaust, the story of the other that created that. But I also think of the story of how we got to the moon, their belief systems. And I think that's really important to understand that perception is reality. And yet, reality may not be reality. And so there's this whole idea of faction, fact plus fiction equals faction. And so when I tell that story, I try to remind people that, you know, we can talk about how stories have elements like plot, character, setting, conflict, et cetera. But we forget that kind of one of the most important elements to any story is memory, and that memory changes, and that how we perceive things change, and that if we are not telling stories to one another, if we are not sitting and listening as much as telling the stories, we're kind of missing out on what's really going on. And that kind of at the beginning, you know, I say the sustainability story. But to me, storytelling has always been about sustainability. You know, it was before we had the internet and smartphones, we had to sit down with one another and tell story. We had to tell stories to entertain ourselves, to dream, to deal with the big mysteries in life, but to also not to eat that mushroom over there because so-and-so ate it and got really sick or died. And so it's been a keen thing. And now we're really losing that ability to kind of understand all the different hues of how story comes into our world and influences who we are and the worlds we are making. So I think that it's important to understand that we need to re-see story, and that it's not just an entertainment vehicle, but it's as much about communion with the earth and nature, and kind of these big stories of mystery as much as it is about telling better stories of our organizations in ways that that are truthful, that are honest and bold stories. I don't think we were going to change the world with shallow storytelling. You know, we have to tell and be honest about our stories. And there's a lot of the story that we have in the world. I think we have the disease of narcissism that's really crept into a lot of organizational storytelling or kind of leadership storytelling, where people talk about the hero's journey. And one, you can tell that if you've read the hero's journey, you can tell they haven't read the hero's journey or read Campbell. But it's the way we're using story to manipulate others. And so, I also try to remind people that story, kind of false stories or what I call story selling, if it's not a true story, I believe that we have developed a kind of a common sense, a bullshit meter, if you will, for stories that are not necessarily true. And we create what I call is the anti-story. So not against, the anti-story is you see something from a big corporation and they tell their kind of perfectly scripted PR story, and everybody in the room who's there rolls their eyes and says, yeah, I don't believe that. So that's the other side of that story. That's the anti-story. And we have a lot of anti-story, and that gets in the way of people actually believing in how organizations are going to, you know, implement change, as an example, because they tell overly scripted, perfect stories that nobody believes and nobody will talk about. And they become these strange little belief systems, and we're caught up in just kind of creating kind of ziggurats to false gods. And that's a big piece of, you know, I think what we can do in organizational storytelling is part of breaking down the silos is naming the false gods that we create so we can create a better story, so we can create a better organization that tells a story that's brave and maybe sometimes not necessarily perfect, but it's authentic and it's genuine, and that people go to work at the organization that they feel connected to what they do. They feel connected to their sense of fate and destiny and purpose in life, that they don't just kind of go to work as zombies and wait until they go home to start their real life. Because I feel like that they're connected to, you know, an organization is just a bunch of people trying to go in the direction of, you know, of the mission and vision. And, yeah, so I think, you know, we live in a really interesting time, and the role of being storytellers in organizations, there's just so much, I think at the heart of it, we have to be tricksters. We have to bring in stories to kind of be deviants and make people uncomfortable, but know that in doing so and using story or talking, looking at the visuals of story, it changes all these bad habits of that are creating worlds that aren't necessarily sustainable at all or happy.
Yeah, gosh, that's what a great conversation. It's very interesting insight. I want to open the conversation up to maybe, you know, one or two more quick questions, but then also give you another minute or two to share with us a little bit more about your book. So Let me go ahead and open up to the rest of the group. Any other questions? Follow up questions for Jeff?
Jeff, this is Tom speaking, and I'm very interested in your idea, and I'm sure it's not only your idea, but the idea of telling stories without words and how that can cause problems. The words can cause problems, especially if it has to do, I would guess, with the anti-stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so could you say a little bit more about those techniques, because you mentioned that you could graph a story and then bring everybody together, I guess, through the graph, but I'm having trouble imagining how people share their stories without words in a way that brings everybody onto the same page.
Sure. Well, it's so I'll give you an example. I was with a big client, East Coast client, that they were a nonprofit, but a big one focused on environmental watershed and the role of their work and how to work with hydropower and other types of renewable energy. And but they were kind of a disassociated group of a kind of a collection of folks, and they wanted to come together around kind of seeing a new story and really deeply connecting back to their mission and vision of the organization, but also really seeing the future. And every time they would get together and they would try to kind of hash out a new mission statement or vision in their retreats, people would just end up fighting over words and just overly wordsmithing. And so I came in with them, and, you know, I fundamentally talk about, and I can say a little bit about this with my book, where in my book I brought in the story of the Frog Prince. But what I talk with a lot of organizations about is how, storytelling is primarily a right brain practice. I mean, it's a whole brain practice, but there's a lot of right brain that we bring into it. And so we need to learn how to imagine together to really go forward together. But focusing on the words gets us off track. So I start by saying, we all have a dominant side. You know, you're right-handed, as an example. And while I am right-handed, I use my left hand all the time. Thank you very much. I'm holding the phone to my left hand. and it helps me out, right? But I would never tie my left hand behind my back and then try to go solve things in life or just live my life. I would never do that. But we now live in a culture that particularly out of kind of the last 500 years, where we have more and more demonized the right brain and discounted it. You know, we say it's not, doesn't, you know, these things, the things of the right brain, you know, the creative, the intuition, the image. But it has a different language. And over time, I feel like we're, you know, it used to be, obviously, there was a time where we were, humans were so right-brained that, where, you know, it's like that movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy, where the Coke bottle falls from the sky and people look at the Coke bottle and they start worshiping the Coke bottle. You know, there was a time where the right brain was out of balance with the left brain, and we needed to develop the ability to discern things and think, have critical thinking and think through things. But now we have just go so far in the opposite direction that we can't access our right brains together. So we are literally trying to solve our organizational and social problems with half our brains. So I remind people, you know, Einstein, as an example, when he was developing his theory of relativity, he would stand for hours holding a heavy, like a coffee can, I'm pretty sure it was a coffee can, but it was a heavy weight. And he would sit and he would get himself in kind of an intuitive state, and he would, in his mind's eye, picture himself running along the beach. So he was running exactly along the line with a ray of light, where he was following a ray of light. And this is how he really came to understand the rule of the theory of relativity, you know, and... But he was using his mind to image that and to envision this. We need to do that now. I mean, if you look around where you are right now, wherever you are, everything in your room was once an idea. And, you know, the original Greek word of technology, it's the whole idea of how – it's the art and craft of how we make the inner outer. And so we talk about technology and we think of actual, like, hardcore, like, computer tech. But the original technology truly was storytelling about how do we birth these images outside of ourselves in a way that makes meaning with others. So with this group, I had them go through a process of what I call reverse storyboarding, where I asked them to envision kind of a North Star or a vision that's aspirational of where they want to be in 5 or 10 years, as an example. And they have to kind of collectively understand what that is. But if you start wordsmithing it, you can see how people start controlling things, over-controlling things. Some people disengage. But, boy, you ask people to draw what that looks like and then kind of move back. So let's say I give them 8 storyboards, and they start with the end storyboard of what is it going to look like at the end of 5 years. And then kind of tell the story backwards. This is a it's deceptively simple, but it's really difficult. And you see all sorts of stuff come up. As an example, some people will say, I can't draw, I'm not creative, they get really angry. And it's because it's the left brain trying to control things. We're so used to trying to control things, so used to trying to control the words. But the more you force organizations and groups to, as an example, create images together, first, working with the images first, they then can move and create words and stories and tell stories that matter. But once we start using the words, we go down another rabbit hole of command and control language, you know, perfected scripts and talking points and whatnot, where people don't believe it. So, you know, with this group, it was really helpful. And, you know, they were a group that was half engineers that was there. And they completely struggled. And so some people wouldn't follow the assignment, and they would just basically create PowerPoint slides with just words and bullet points on it. But because they refused to do the image work. And I always say, you know, part of the imaging practices that I use, we all understand if you go on a walk or a hike or a jog or you're washing dishes and you have that aha moment, right? Your brain has moved from beta to theta or alpha waves, right? We need to be able to figure out ways to induce an aha moment with organizations, and by working in different ways of imagery and group imagery, group mandala making as an example, I'll have people do that, and it terrifies them and they have fun, but it induces the aha moment, just as some of the storytelling that I do, it induces an aha moment. And to me, that's the gold in it, is having them go through the process so they're like, oh, now I get it. It's an image. It's an image first. And then they're able to move forward, and it develops a new practice. You know, they're able to get, you know, when you have the image and you kind of go through that process, you think through it differently. You have kinesthetic learnings. You are able to understand things in a spatial way that's different. And people aren't just living in their heads trying to control each other through talking points. That's what I do a lot with kind of the image and the story work. And I take it actually out of how I develop and plan my own stories as a performing storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Kind of use that process.
Like with my stories, you know, the way they, you know, before we had widespread literacy, that's why we have archetypes. We have symbols because symbols hold paradox. We have to riddle through them, which holds more meaning, which is why we've had all these kind of, you know, the riddles of the Sphinx and all these great imageries and tarot cards as an example. As a performing storyteller, the way I can remember more stories is I go through an image process of learning images through kind of an oral narrative way, and then I draw them out. And I learn a different landscape each time I do. But internally, I develop kind of this inner storyboard. And so when I go and tell a story, or I'm performing a story and I'm playing a drum and all this other stuff, I'm always telling the same story based on the images that I'm kind of walking through in my mind, these kind of rich living images in my head. But the words may be different that come out, depending on the audience and the setting and the time. And I think that there's a, you know, in organizational work, we understand the importance of having a loose, tight design. You know, design where we work with people, where we have stories that give people enough room that they can see their own story in the story, but not so tight that it triggers people's cynicism and disbelief and creates the anti-story so they don't go along with the change practice or just think it's a bunch of, you know, top-down stuff. And I think that this image work is just key to that. And at the end of the day, it also makes people more creative. You know, they love it. I find a lot of people say, I never realized I was this type of a learner, and it's really helped me. And, you know, and I'm happy to say I'm a terrible stick figure person, and I force myself to go through it. but
well,
it's really, you know.
I think there's a few of us there, but what you've explained, you know, kind of motivates me to leverage off of that. I know it's hard to imagine that we've actually been going at this for about 50 minutes or so, but I we're close to our time frame. But I wanted to make sure, Jeff, that you had, you know, at least a minute or so to share with us a little bit about your book before we end for the day.
Sure. Well, thank you. You know, I have certainly touched on a number of the ideas that are in the book, but I would just say that this, you know, my book is it's written for kind of a business professional who's doing sustainability work and that type of press. But I didn't want it to kind of cheapen the idea of story by just making it about kind of one aspect of it. You know, I would say there are many on-ramps to story and why it's important. But to me, I think, you know, when I say storytelling for sustainability, it's really important that, you know, I, in this book, I really ask, you know, we say we tell stories, but do we ever ask ourselves, what are we actually storytelling for? What are we, you know, what's the intention behind the stories we tell? And so for me, you know, I have basically said, you know, the distinction for me in kind of storytelling for sustainability is based around kind of three kind of basic premises of, you know, we tell stories for sustainability because we want to increase the quality of life, that we want a right or wrong in the world, and we want to prevent the end of something good. And that at the end of the day that we understand as storytellers that, you know, the role of the storyteller is an ancient one, and that in many cases it's been to restore the order of the imagination through the stories we tell. And so while we're trying to right a wrong and prevent the end of something good, I've also woven a four-part telling of the Frog Prince into the book, in part because I want people to have kind of reflective moments when they're moving through the book to really think about the role of story and imagination as a key aspect of storytelling. And I also present it as a way for people to understand how you can use, quote, a fictional story to talk about sacred truths that we know. And so there's kind of a reflective aspect to each level of the Frog Prince story. And I remind people in the book that the Frog Prince was actually the Joseph Campbell's favorite story and the kind of the key story that he hinged his whole hero's journey story around, not just Star Wars, which I know I hear a lot of, but it was about the Frog Prince. And so I think that's it was kind of a fun surprise. So I've woven that in there to try to talk to kind of these different levels of story. I speak to the role of, you know, organizational stories, how to tell better stories, and I presented a model that I call the triple storyline, where I help people recognize that to tell stories that matter and make a difference, we need stories that have kind of three characteristics, and that is, one, that there are elements of the individual, the person, that there's the element of people and organization and communities, but most importantly, that we have the element of place in all of our stories, and that place has our sense of place, where we dwell, how we live, has such an important element to how we move in the world, and whether or not we leave a world that's there for our children or we don't, or that we tell stories that are going to ultimately be our demise of why we need stuff, or we tell stories that help us reimagine the future, and we are all able to coalesce around that vision. And so, you know, it's a short book. There are a lot of things that you could go off into kind of a deeper subject areas, but I wanted to give people kind of a holistic understanding of how to use story and how to use story and kind of, with images, and to recognize that we're not going to change the world unless we tell deep and meaningful stories. And so we need to understand just how we connect into that. And that the book is there to help amplify the work. If you're already doing PR communications, if you're doing organizational storytelling, the book is there to help amplify and deepen your work. And if you're just trying to get into story and you really think the role of leadership and kind of authentic, genuine narrative leadership is important in telling, learning how to tell your story, it has something there too. And so, yeah, so it's I think it's a fun book, and I will certainly, happy to talk with you about it more, and I hope it makes a difference in the world.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for not only sharing your latest baby, if you will, but your time and your perspective. Hard to imagine that. We're almost at the top of the hour, and the time has gone by so quickly, and thank you to everybody for being so engaged and having some thoughtful questions, which led to some very interesting insights. So, Jeff, again, thank you very much for your time, and thanks for being a member.
Thank you all.
Oh. Tom, I think we could go ahead and end our recorded session.
Yes. Okay. So thanks, everybody, and have a great evening.
Thank you very much. Jeff,
right.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye now.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.